Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of The Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to the distinguished actor Robert Bathurst about his play Geoffrey Bernard is Unwell, about the roué Geoffrey Bernard, who wrote for The Spectator, and the play is taking place actually in The Coach and Horses, his favourite local. Tell me, Robert, it's rather an odd play, but it's absolutely wonderful. Tell me about the how it came together, the actual play in the first place.
The play was a collation by the playwright Keith Waterhouse, who took the 15 years of I think 800-word pieces by Bernard in his column Low Life. It started off, Alexander Chancellor commissioned him for just a short time, and it took off, and he paired it with Taki in High Life. So the first thing that a lot of people turned to in the 80s and 90s was Low Life, and it would be Geoffrey Bernard talking about his life, and life as sort of in the gutter in Soho, but it would be laced with stories of not just drinking, which would be boring, but it would be and racing. He was an extraordinary character who was killing himself. And Jonathan Meads described Low Life as a 15-year suicide note. But he lived self-determination. He lived in life entirely the way he intended to conduct it, and along the way there was damage. I mean, there were four wives, and he does say in one of his pieces, as comes up in the play, that for a boozer of his scale, marriage is impossible. And there's a lot of self-knowledge in there as well. And so what Waterhouse did for the theatre, directed by Ned Sherrin, was he put the show, set it in the Coach and Horses pub on stage, and he had four actors doing scenes from his life with it. So it was a theatre show that ran for quite a while. And
with Peter O'Toole?
Peter O'Toole did it, and it was the first to do it, and then various other actors have done it since in its theatrical form. But then I got invited to do it in the Coach and Horses itself, which immediately appealed, because of to do it in situ as a one-person show, there's no room for four other actors, hardly room enough for me. And to do it, and I wanted to do it, I didn't want to do it too flouncily, you know. I wanted to do it the more self-reflecting Bernard, and the sort that...
So flouncily, you mean more theatrical, you mean?
Or? Yeah, perhaps. I mean, if you look at the Arena documentary that they did at the time of the launch of the show, it is Bernard at his most reflective. It's not and he is drunk when he's doing the show. I mean, the point is, he spent the night in the pub, he's been locked in, and he's been drinking all night. So yes, he is off his face, but I just wanted to capture the reflective Bernard as depicted of him before 11 a.m. And it's a celebration of his writing before 11 a.m. Some people have queried as to whether we should be celebrating drunkenness and liver damage, but it's not about that.
Well, you say you've written a brilliant article about it for the latest issue of The Oldie. You did put in a joke warning, is that right, at one stage?
Well, I was aware that this sort of "dah" quality to it wasn't a la mode in terms of people's tastes and what people felt there should be seeing, and the Cromwellians amongst us were finding it a bit not offensive, but were worried about how people might receive it. And so I put in an ironic trigger warning on the show. I've done it four times now. It's for short periods. It's like a sort of temporary residency at the Coach and Horses, and I love the fact that it's established and it's sort of a Soho event, should we say. And I put this trigger warning on the show, which was, this show contains references to smoking, gambling, alcohol and sex, which, of course, to any a good judge would be an ironic warning. But the Daily Mail contacted the PR people, and they put me in touch by email and said, why is he doing a trigger warning? All these shows have trigger warnings. This is nonsense. And so I replied by email. They said, well, this is ironic, and I'm just listing four perfectly legal adult activities. Possibly the most problematic of all is that the show also contains humour. And anyway, they printed that, and I was very pleased by that.
And it's incredibly enjoyable. I've seen you do it. Quite hard to actually manage the business of it, isn't it? Because the Coach and Horse is quite a small pub. You fit in, what, 70 people?
About 70, yeah.
And you're behind the bar, you come in front of the bar. But was it very, very difficult to transfer it from what it would originally been on stage to a small pub in Soho?
Any sort of theatrical, any performance is about making sure the audience are engaged. So if the audience are, in this case, are strung out, 70 of them are strung out in three distinct sections, open planned distinct sections of the pub, the performer has to be aware that at any one point, some of them are going to be disadvantaged. So I keep moving. And I move out from behind the bar. There are three flaps in the bar, which I use. Sometimes I have to plough through people who are sort of wedged in them, and I go through them the whole time, and stepping over people and squeezing past people, and people are very, very close, and I find you have to, it's a feat of concentration upon you, because you have to sort of, you know, I see people I know well who are sitting either at the bar or sitting wedged in these seats and stuff like that. So the main thing is to engage the audience who are there, and if they're down the far end, make sure that the people down the far end get the benefit as soon as possible. And so there is a fluidity to it. It's not just standing there and spouting out and doing it. There is a flow to it, a physical flow to it. And just to make sure that the brilliant language, I love the language in it. I love the way he writes.
He's a brilliant writer. I was going to ask that, perhaps there must be other examples, but it's quite odd to have journalism, which everyone normally says is, you know, tomorrow's chip wrapper, being put together to produce a play and for it to work so brilliantly. But he was a wonderful writer. Is that basically the secret? If it's terrific writing, it will work.
Absolutely. I mean, he always went for the gag. He always went for the beat, the moment, the moment it engaged. So as a performer, when you're trying to engage an audience, you're dealing with writing which was written to engage, written to entertain. Written to not to, to move to some extent, no, but he's never one for self pity. I mean, he had every right to be self pitying. I mean, he was a diabetic who never took his insulin and ended up with his leg off. He was an eternal gambler. His pieces in the sporting life were about losing. They were about so he was never bitter about losing. He was philosophical about losing, but he was a gambler, and he wrote brilliantly about horse racing. I loved his, and he wrote.
But you're a very, very keen punter yourself.
Yeah. I'm not a keen punter. I'm a keen follower of horse racing. Yeah. My punting is very limited, and I don't float the levy to any great degree. But I do have the odd bit here and there. But he would bet and would. He would need the money from the spectator to pay for his next trip to Corals. So he was proper in that sense. But he was never, as you say, never self-pitying. So you winced for him and with him to some extent, certainly for him. He was a brilliant, brilliant comic writer.
And always, if he is self-pitying, it's in the service of a joke. So when asked whether he'd write his memoir, you'll know this story, he remembered Douglas Bader's famous memoir, Reach for the Sky. He wanted to call his Reach for the Ground, which is a brilliant joke, isn't it? But it's making a joke out of self-pity, therefore it's not self-pitying.
Exactly that, yeah. Exactly that, yeah. No, his pieces were very well drawn by Pete Waterhouse. I mean, of course he didn't write them for the stage, but they lend themselves very well to speech. And that, to some extent, is an underrated thing that Keith Waterhouse has brought to it, because Keith Waterhouse was a playwright and he understood about connecting to an audience. So he crafted and collated and edited the written material in a way which lands with an audience.
And comes up with the overarching premise of Jeff being locked in the pub, and that then locks together all the separate pieces, is that right?
Yes, and it's of course a conceit that he's on his own at 5 o'clock in the morning, having spent the first part of the night in the lavatory. And he complains to Norman later in the thing on the phone. He says, why the hell didn't you call time gents, please, in the gents? but he was, yes, and then he'd woven his way into the, after waking up in the lav, he worked into the thing, and he caned a bottle of vodka during the night. So, of course, he's on his own, but of course there's 70 people in the pub with him, and he's talking to them. So you have to invite the audience to sort of enjoy the fact that he's talking to them, but they're not there.
And it was originally a play with other actors in it. It's been adapted to be just you. You wrote another brilliant article for the Oldie last year about the difficulty of remembering lines. This must be very difficult because it is a monologue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an hour straight through. And I find that good writing is easy to learn. And whenever when learning it, you sort of go off it, and you think, well, that's not the right word, isn't it? And you always look to the script, and of course, it's always the perfect word. He's chosen the best word for that beat.
And the rhythm of the sentences, like all good writers, is always right.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so in a sense, It once it's in, it stays. Well, it stays in because I know I'm having to do it again. I mean, it's an occasional show. It's a sort of every year. I think for the last 4 years, I've turned up and done it for a few shows. So I haven't had to relearn it every time. I have to some extent had to relearn it, but it's there and it's bizarre. And I'm not a brain scientist, but I know that I'm going to have to stand on my hind legs and do it again. It sort of isn't a difficult relearn.
Because the ghosts of the lines are always there. But if I'd asked you, say, last June to do it just off pat, you couldn't have done it. But with a couple of weeks of revising, as it were, it comes back to life.
I started again knowing that this was coming up in January. I think sometime in September or something like that, I started to sort of go through it in my head. And it was more or less there, yeah.
And you've done a huge amount on film and telly and stage. Is this the most enjoyable form of acting?
I mean, the responsibility is totally mine. I mean, it's sharing with something when it works is brilliant. It's great. But I do relish the fact that I can make all the choices, and any show you do, a multicast show, of course, has a different way of doing it. You know, you are responsible for your little island, but you've also got to make sure you're. It's very important to know when you're on stage with other people, when you're Eric and when you're Ernie, and when are you feeding and when are you paying off, and the best writing can often make you Eric sometimes and Ernie some other times, if you're Ernie, you on stage with people, you are representing the concentration of the audience, and it's very easy to muck up someone's lines by doing extraneous moves, and you can think of a number of people who do that.
Which and you can't possibly name.
No. And so by focusing on them, not standing like a plank, but receiving what they're saying, the audience receive it too. And likewise, the responsibility of the other person is to be Ernie when you're being Eric.
Right.
So in a one person show like this, you're being both Eric and Ernie because you're teeing up the payoff. But that is all Bernard. I mean, Bernard will tee up his gag, and he'll pay it off. But it's fun doing both.
Because it's often said by actors in films, movies, that a lot of it is waiting around, waiting to go on set, and it's quite boring. Is that the case or not?
It's very boring for people who have been to a charity auction and they've paid a considerable sum to be extras in a TV show. And I've done that several times. That people have come along in a very excited state to watch the filming. And within 2 hours, they've lost the will to live. Yeah.
Because they're waiting around.
Well, yeah, they don't understand why all these people are hanging around, apparently doing nothing. They can't understand why, when you've done it once, why that isn't it. Well, of course, you're doing it from lots of different angles. I mean, the whole filming day is about keeping, if as a performer, it's about keeping a level of energy at 8 in the morning and at 7 at night. And you've got to be prepared to jump to when the need arises in that time. So you can't expend all your energy in the morning and you've got nothing left in the afternoon. So there is, you have to sort of put yourself slightly into stasis for some of that period. And yet keep the bubble of focus and concentration going, as well as sort of talking about inconsequential things in the makeup department, you know, just sort of keeping the spirits up. So, the filming day is a very different rhythm to a performance show, and people really don't get it. But to say it's boring, it would be boring to witness, but when you're in it, it just flies, usually.
And also, presumably, that's part of the job, though, you know, the boring parts of being a journalist, the boring parts of being a plumber. It's just that that's a different way of working.
Well, acting is simply, you could reduce it to this, and this, of course, is trite to say it, but it's about plausible repetition. And you'd be able to everybody can act once, in my opinion. Everybody can...
Meaning what? What do you mean?
Well, you've just said, meaning what? What do you mean? Now, you've got to say that 20 times. So you've got to say, meaning what? What do you mean? With the same forensic thrust that you've just employed 20 times, and make me believe that you are as sharp as you were on the first time you said it. So everybody can do that once. The question is finding it again. And again, and being plausible on every occasion. So that's part of the technique of it.
To talk more generally about your life and career, you were born in Ghana, is that right?
Well, I was born in the Gold Coast, which was a British colony, and was about to become Ghana. 10 days after I was born, it became Ghana. And because my father had been born outside the UK, I would have been Ghanaian if I'd been born 10 days later. So I missed out on that.
And what was your father doing?
He was a mining engineer. He was in the engineers in Burma in the war and spent 25 years getting back to the UK, pretty much. He was living abroad and working abroad in Africa and Ireland until I was about 10.
And then you moved to Ireland, is that right?
We moved to Ireland when I was 2.
Right.
And then I spent a few years in Ireland.
But it's funny, you know, you are very famous for playing Englishman. Do you think actually being a slight outsider made you even better at playing Englishman? Although, of course, you are English, but as a slight observer, an insider, outsider?
I think that's... Yes, I mean, I have never done therapy. This is my first therapy session, Harry. I think you're probably right, although I haven't ever unpacked that.
I can't notice much Ghanaian or Irish in your accent, Robert.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And very often, people who observe a world are not from within it. My former collaborators... Petey and Taylor, who do the Alex cartoon in the Telegraph, Charles Petey and Russell Taylor, they have satirised the city. I've done a stage show based on the Alex character with them, or Charles in particular. But Charles and Russell, they are not city brokers, and yet they have city investment bankers, and they have satirised, and they have anticipated every big bang, boom, crash and crunch since 1985 with great perception and foresight, and yet they're not in it. So I think very often people who are, I mean, you could say Oscar Wilde was an outsider within the world that he was satirising. I mean, any number, Dean Swift, and any number of people were. And I think it's the same in the acting thing. You have, if you are completely in it, you don't necessarily see the... See what it is. You don't get what it is you're doing unless you're an outsider. Perhaps you could argue you see it more clearly.
Yeah, and then at Cambridge you read law, but you always wanted to be an actor. Is that right?
I was from the age of 13. I mean, again, here I am on the oldie couch, From the age of 13, I said to an actress who is well known for comedy and film, and actors don't normally say, "What did it for you? What was it?" You know, like that. And I asked her. I did say to her, when did you first twig that this is what you wanted to do? And she said something that struck a chord. She said, "They're getting a laugh in the school play." And so I'm sure that's the same for a lot of people, is that you do something at a formative time, an incredibly formative time in the early teens, when you think, crikey, that was, ooh, I'd like to have another taste of that. And I'm like, that strikes a chord with me. But of course, I loathe announcing my ambitions before they're realised, yeah. which is self-protection and cowardice in equal measure.
And pragmatism.
Pragmatism, yeah. Possibly, indeed. So, I mean, I could call it pragmatism. You call it pragmatism. But you just don't want to be held up and hoisted with hubris. I did shows throughout school. I did shows throughout university. I did shows beyond, ex-university stuff that I was doing.
And you were in the Footlights at Cambridge, yeah. all 3 years.
I did three, and then we got together after we'd left and toured Australia. A pop promoter took us around Australia in 1981, and we were treated like kings. It was just fantastic.
Is this Botham the musical?
It was called Botham the musical. Yeah. Botham had done his heroics at Headingley that summer, and we were touring Australia, so yes, and it was before everything was something the musical. It was I'd say we were in there early adopters of that form, but it wasn't about the musical and it wasn't about Botham, which confused the Australian press rather, because they, for when we did a press conference, they kept on saying, "Can we have the guy that played Botham?"
No mention of him at all in the show.
No, not at all. It was just simply saying we won the Ashes. Right. I mean, it was pathetic. Yes, I mean, yes, it was sort of cheap point scoring.
And we're talking just after the sad death of Tony Slattery, who was younger than you, but you did work with him.
I did stuff with him. I mean, I didn't do much. I knew him and enjoyed him. And we were in a show, a TV show at one point together. I'm older than he's been. I knew him and enjoyed him. I've followed his successes and winced at his self destruction. A lot of people have been saying things, and I'm very glad that he's had the recognition, immediate recognition of his talents. I wish he'd been able to read all those in his lifetime. I last saw him. I went around backstage to see him in Edinburgh 2 years ago, I think. And he'd been brilliant. I mean, he'd been wonderful, and it was fantastic to see him because physically and in many other, perhaps in other ways, he was complicated, but he was funny, and he was I'd say iconoclastic was the sort of thing. He just was his own man, his own person, and he was funny about improvisation shows which were scripted. I mean, that was one of his shticks at the time, and I thought, yeah, that's good, because the people aren't as brave as he was, and he knew that they weren't as good as he was, and he knew that, and wasn't shy of telling people. So there was much to celebrate about Tony, and much to mourn, because mourn, yes, absolutely, but I mean, he lived life the way he conducted it, and he ended life earlier than he otherwise might if he hadn't gone on the way he did. But if he hadn't gone on the way he did, perhaps some of his genius wouldn't have been on show.
And Robert, your big break was in Cold Feet, and then you have often played, I don't know if you've got a sort of caption for it, but Tortured Englishman. Do you mind that? Do you mind going up for those roles and being given those roles?
No, I mean, when the part came, I could see this was in 96, was the part we filmed the pilot, and he was set up as a sort of Thatcherite boo boy, really, ex-yuppie, was the, certainly as described, in the sort of rubric, and we've done 9 series, was it now? And you can't sustain that all the time. You have to find a chink of humanity. I'm aware that sometimes in television drama, television comedy, that anyone of that sort isn't allowed any redeeming human qualities whatsoever. So you always have to try and find them, and find the complication. The complication was there in the writing, but you know, trying to squeeze it and play it. I love playing David, and also he was allowed to get older in the second outing we did. He was allowed to be occasionally surprising, come up with things which you wouldn't ordinarily have expected. He was allowed to learn. Very often, the difference in sitcoms and comedy dramas, or dramas anyway, generally, is that characters never learn from what they've done. They always return to point A.
The character returns.
And so the character in a sitcom, proper, true sitcom, will never say, but when I did this, you know, they've done nothing. They're always year zero whenever, at the beginning of every episode. Whereas in dramas, the danger is to make a character always return back to year zero and never learn. But Cold Feet, the characters were allowed to learn, which is part of the success of his development.
And warm to him more, didn't you?
Like sort of any shared history with people, even if you find them annoying, you're with them. And there's a wonderful film at the moment called The Real Pain with Culkin, Kieran Culkin in it. And you get really annoyed by him for about an hour, and you adore him for the next half an hour. You know, you just think, oh, you poor guy. You know, having gone, oh God, how could you be like that? And I love the fact that one can change one's mind about people, and accept them for what they are.
And you've essentially played John Le Mesurier twice in a way. You played him as himself in the drama about Hadji Jakes, and then played his part in Dad's Army. Were you a fan of his acting, John Le Mesurier's?
Always, yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, he had an extraordinary precision. I mean, and apparent diffidence, but it was diamond sharp. He knew what he was doing, and. I auditioned for the Hattie job when Hattie and John and her lover John, and I wasn't sure. I would usually every job I do, I always think I'm not right for it, and are you sure? Anyway, you never know until you do it. I mean, you never know until, and also on the set, you just hope that. I love there's one thing about filming is you hope that nobody on this sounds a bit, but no, it's true. And on the set, you hope that people don't notice what you're doing, they notice it in the edit, and they think, oh, great, you know, I see, oh yeah, and so I try to do that with Lemez, and you're not playing to the room, and the playing in the John Lemay's character in The Hattie was a perfect example of trying to slip in a character which wasn't obviously there in the room, I may be overstating it a bit, but you sort of find it and hope it works on screen. You don't try and score in the read through, particularly. Try and get the voice, but in terms of what's going on behind the eyes, you can't get that through in a read through. So it only works if it works on screen, it was a challenge, and I love doing it.
It's quite hard to be understated, isn't it? Those stories which you hear a lot of great Hollywood movie actors saying of the 40s and 50s, older actors saying to them, "Remember, you're going to be on a screen 30 foot by 15 foot.
Yeah,
play it down." Then it must be quite difficult to know whether you're playing it down too much.
Well, the audience are in the lens, and I do think, I mean, this is a sort of technical chat, really. But I find that if it's comedy, I don't know if I should say it. It is comedy, and I find if there's in on the set, there's always somebody holding a boom with a microphone quite close to you, not far, but no, not close. And I find if the boom operator is laughing, I cut what I'm doing.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
and because you think it's too much. Being it's dialed
too, up. Yeah. You know, working with comedians is interesting because they need laughter in the room very often, and very often they get bored after two takes because no one else they've heard the jokes. They're not laughing anymore. I sort of tend to work in the opposite way of resolutely trying, making sure that it's not played to the room.
There was a thing for Alan Bennett's 90th birthday the other day, a documentary. He said it annoyed him that in Beyond the Fringe, the crew never laughed at him and Jonathan Miller on set, and they always laughed at Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. But then they're all brilliant in the final thing, aren't they? But you can see...
Yeah,
exactly,
but you see, what the great mistake is to think that the crew are in any way interested in what you're doing. The crew are interested in the lighting. They're interested in the sound and whether there's any echo coming off the walls. The costume makeup. Nobody gives a fig what you're up to, and then you're not playing to them, and that takes away all the nerves of a film set. I mean, the first day on a film set is very nervous because you start getting paranoid, but yeah, after if you've had the luck to be in a show which is you're a regular in it or whatever, you ease into it and you're not worried about what they think because they're not thinking about what you're thinking. They're thinking about their own department. And the other thing is that when you're doing a sitcom, you show the show in rehearsal room to all the technicians who come piling in on the Friday, if you're doing a Sunday recording, say, and they come in on the Friday and they only laugh at the dirty stuff. You know, it's only the broader stuff. So Alan Bennett needn't have worried because all his subtleties would be received by the audience firsthand, and the crew are not the best judges of that.
Yes, how interesting. And also, that I was talking to Kenneth Cranham on Radio Aldi, and I was talking about another actor who said how good he thought he was, and he said, without being rude about him, he just went, "Oh yeah, he can do it." And yeah. That was great. It was just sort of. It's an extraordinary thing being able to act well. Yeah. Do you think, in a way, it is kind of binary? You can either do it or you can't. Doesn't mean you don't stop working at it, but
it's a technical appreciation, really. I mean, you don't have necessarily to be moved by what people are doing because you can see what they're doing as an actor. You can do that, but technically, you might appreciate what they're up to and say, "Yeah, I can do it. Yeah, that works all right." So Kenneth Cranham, I had a chat with him about doing Loot. What I love about meeting actors, I mean, I'm now venerable and old myself, but I've always enjoyed meeting older actors because they are a through line to some great connections. I mean, you know, and I'd love talking to Ken about knowing Joe Orton. Joe, and that was, I mean, the same with June Whitfield or something. What was Jimmy Edwards like and all that sort of stuff.
That's wonderful.
I love that first-hand thread, golden thread with the past.
Robert, I loved you in Toast of London, which was absolutely fantastic and very, very unusual and original. Did you know when you first got the script for that this is, I can't think of anything like it. It's completely of its own kind, isn't it?
I say, when I read it, I didn't get it. I mean, I thought, this is so odd that I really want to do this. You know, I really wasn't sure. I couldn't sort of see it. And it wasn't until we started filming the pilot, I thought, oh, I see what's going on. And but its very oddness was appealing. And the more I sort of did it, the more Arthur and Matt's scripts were involved in them. I did say to Matt, actually, when we were recording one not so long ago, And it didn't really, I don't think it necessarily registered with him. He was rather puzzled by what I said. But I did think, returning to Joe Orton again, I said, actually, the syntax, the language is rather like Joe Orton in some ways. It's got that sort of skewed way of talking, which reminds me of Orton. And the other thing about Toast is of the many things that I enjoyed about it, is their comedy names. Now, comedy names, you can sometimes read a comedy script that comes in, and you can write off, you can say this is going to be rubbish because the names are so awful. you know, Blenkinsop Fortescue or something like that. You know, you just think, no, this is going to be rubbish. Whereas their names, which are like fridge magnets, really, they get two names and put them together, and so you have
Ray Bloody Purchase,
Kikini Bamalam, Pookie Hook, and all those ones, which were the magnificent. And what I also adore about Toast is my fear that it was just an industry inside gag. It was completely wrong, because it's got a really wide catchment of people who claim to love it, and so I think I think we did 12 episodes of Toast of London, and there was six of the of a Los Angeles one, and I hardly appeared in that. I only turned up in an S&M parlor in LA, but the character Ed, who was in the kitchen most of the time spinning the narrative along, became more and more perverted as time went on. And I adore playing him.
But it is, you never know, however brilliant something is, like you've just said about the script for Toast London, when you're filming it, or Cold Feet, you don't ever think, I know this is going to be a hit. You never know.
Well, I could say, if you could equate Cold Feet and Toast, they both had a not dissimilar genesis, or story, not genesis, or development. Cold Feet, we did the pilot, which went out in 97 on the night of Channel 5 was launched, and the Grand Prix overran before streaming, of course, and so anyone who wanted to watch it had taped it, and they only got half of it. No one read about it. Roma wrote about it. You'd open the papers the next day, no one mentioned it. There was that awful yawning time for a couple of months after the pilot went out, when you realise that momentum was draining from this project. And Andy Harris, who was at that time at Granada, persuaded ITV, who had pretty much written it off, and they hadn't certainly supported it and hadn't wanted to do any hadn't expressed a desire to do anything with it, to put it in as the second string ITV entry for the Montreux Comedy TV Comedy Awards. It was a second stream. I can't remember what went in first, but for ITV. But anyway, it won the gold. It won the gold thing. And then, of
having
course,
done the first series,
the pilot,
just the pilot,
just
right.
the pilot,
right.
and had been, ITV hadn't really backed it and hadn't really been. And Andy was having a difficult time getting them to pay attention to it. Then it wins the gold, and of course, figures at ITV decided it was really rather good, and then it went from there. But it was very close run thing. Similarly, with Toast of London, we did the first series of that, and again, I could feel the momentum draining. There was no one was mentioning it, and no one was responding about it, like to the people who had made it, and it was beginning to wither. And then, luckily, our executive producer became head of comedy at Channel 4. It had been his instinct to do Toast in the first place. It was his instinct, not just he had a business interest in it, or had. I suspect he had to leave that alone once he was head of comedy at Channel 4. But it was his project. And so he was damned if it wasn't going to get a second go, even though no one had written about it, no one. And then Matt won a BAFTA for it, and it became something that people are still talking about today. So close, so narrow. And I've had other projects which haven't survived.
Which have been extremely good.
Which had potential, of course. I mean, there's been a number, when the momentum was drained, it never came back. And everyone's involved has had something like that. But Toast and Cold Feet were both successes. But very close run things.
So it is sort of tentative. I think in all art forms, it's always interesting if something is absolutely brilliant like those two programs. You would have thought they necessarily do well, but that is not the case. Brilliant things can disappear.
Well, absolutely. There was no return to know. It's in retrospect they were success, brilliant, and the obvious choices for development. But at the time, people didn't see that.
Well, that's a very good point to end my interview with Robert Bathurst on Radio Aldi. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thanks, Harry.
You have been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.